Normally, when U.S.-based applicants talk about the top programs, especially when they refer to the top X, as in the top 10 or the top 20, they are referring to U.S. News Rankings, the granddaddy of educational rankings. Today, we'll hear from U.S. News Executive Editor Anne McGrath and Chief Data Strategist Robert Morse. Welcome to the 265th episode of Admissions Straight Talk, except it's a podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm accepted!" And not only accepted, but accepted at the best program for you. Now, this podcast is sponsored by Fit In and Stand Out, the paradox at the heart of admissions. Fit In Stand Out is Accepted's guide to help you handle that paradox with authenticity and skill. Grab your free copy at accepted.com/FISO, or for Fit In Stand Out. And again, that's accepted.com/FISO. I'm so pleased to have on the show Anne McGrath, Executive Editor at U.S. News & World Report, and Robert, a.k.a. Bob Morse, Chief Data Strategist at U.S. News & World Report. Anne has been with U.S. News since 1985, and Bob has been with U.S. News since 1976. Both are pioneers in the realm of rankings. Now, for all the questions I've ever had about rankings but was afraid to ask, and hopefully these are also some of yours, I can actually get answers. Anne and Bob, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you. We're looking forward to making our best effort to answer all your ranking questions or ranking questions that you've been asked. That here's your chance to get U.S. News to answer them.
Yeah, I was just thinking actually that this is really very unusual. Usually, representatives of U.S. News are asking the questions, not answering them in any case, and I'm usually the one reading about it. It's a pleasure to have you, and I'm really looking forward to this, and I appreciate you taking the time to join me. You've both been at U.S. News since the beginning of the college rankings, I think was around in the 1980s, right? 1987, correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, they did actually start in 83 and 85. They were very short versions in the weekly magazine. 87 was the first guidebook. That's when we started doing them annually.
Can you give a little bit of the backstory to how did this get started? What criteria? How did you choose the criteria that you focused on? Has there been an evolution of the criteria in the rankings?
Yeah, well, there's definitely been an evolution of the criteria. And I actually wasn't involved in the very first two rankings. They were done using a pretty simple reputation-only system where college presidents picked what were their top 10 schools, and then the schools that had the most mentions were the ones that were rated. So it produced pretty small lists. Then in 87 and 87 was the last reputation only ranking. And then we realized in order for the rankings to succeed or make an effort to have them become more acceptable in higher education, stressing the word relatively more acceptable, that we needed to bring in statistical data. So we met with a lot of higher educators and we came up with the criteria to measure academic quality, which is the basis for the rankings today. You know, we knew that there was a big gap of needing consumer information of, you know, how to compare schools to each other. And we thought we could fill that gap by bringing in statistical and reputational data to help families make this pretty expensive decision, which definitely has been rising in price compared to back then.
Oh, yeah.
And we have evolved the methodology over time. From at the beginning, we had put more emphasis on inputs. And recently, we've been evolving towards putting more emphasis on outputs, graduation and retention and predicted graduation rate, which now account for 30% of the methodology. And we've de-emphasized to at least to some degree inputs.
Like test scores, grades, et cetera?
Well, we never had grades.
Right.
I mean, like at one point we had yield and we dropped yield. Mm-hmm. And we have reduced the weight of high school class standing because it's become less prevalent, at least on the East and West Coast, and on high school transcripts. I'm sure you're aware of that. And we made we added the predicted graduation rate. That was something that wasn't part of the initial methodology. So So those are some of the changes that we made.
And is that specifically for the college rankings, or are you talking also about here about the grad rankings, or what are some of the differences between the two?
Well, I mean, the grad rankings and the college rankings in some ways are completely different for two reasons. The college rankings are at the institutional level only, meaning Harvard or Amherst or UCLA or Yale or Princeton or University of Chicago. Even though we picked up data, we're focusing on data that's at the undergraduate level. The graduate rankings, each ranking has its own specifically tailored methodology, and each of the grad rankings is at the program level, like the MBA degree, the medical school, the engineering school, and then each one of them has their own tailored methodology that picks up characteristics of the MBA program or the part-time MBA or the full-time law, the part-time law, or the education or nursing master's degree and nursing doctor, nursing practice. So they all have different methodologies, and some of them are reputation only. Mm-hmm. So it's very different compared to the college rankings, which were using 1,400 schools approximately. They're all more or less using the same methodology, the same ranking factors, but we're dividing them up into the Carnegie categories. So they're being compared within their comparison group, or schools that have similar characteristics using the Carnegie. You know, schools where only doctoral degrees granted, or masters, or liberal arts.
I do think, you know, that's actually one thing that I think a lot of people don't realize, is that the undergraduate business school or undergraduate best colleges ranking is not really just one ranking. It's really sort of 10 different rankings. The national universities are ranked against themselves. The national liberal arts colleges are ranked against themselves, and so on. So I think it gives people more options to sort of look at and compare schools to their own peer group in a way that you often can't do just by doing your own personal research.
It also might give people ideas as to what are peer schools. In other words, you're looking at school A and kind of appeals to you, but maybe it's a little too expensive or too far or not, you can then see that there are other schools that are similar that are perhaps closer or maybe less expensive or have some other appeal that the first school doesn't have, but in some respects, it's still a peer school.
That's right. I think that, you know, as more of a now consumer of the rankings myself in putting them, presenting them in the guidebooks, I think that one of the real values to readers is exactly what you just said, that you can see schools that you might never have even known about five or six states away actually appear to be similar to something that you're considering and might be of interest.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. And that was actually one of the more big successes of the rankings. It has made people more aware of the variety of the U.S. higher education, you know, the different types of schools, and we just lumped them all together, the regional colleges or regional universities or national liberal arts, they would have been invisible. I mean, there's a lot of focus still on top schools, but I think we made people aware of the diversity of U.S. higher education because of using the categories.
And one of my favorite rankings is our A-plus schools for B students ranking, which basically kind of correlates quality and academic excellence with the scores and grades in such a way that you can see what schools you can get into if you don't apply with a GPA of over 4.0.
Well, that sounds very valuable. And is that available only online or both the online and the offline versions?
Both places. It's in both.
Yeah, more. I think everything that's in print is online, but the online version, generally speaking, has far more data, and the pay version of the online has the fullest rankings and data.
Just to clarify for myself as well as for listeners, Bob, it seems to me that you are kind of the statistical genius behind the rankings, the guru that makes sure everything is correct and meaningful and measuring something of value. Anne, could you go a little bit into what your role is?
Sure. I am the editor overseeing publication of our print guidebooks, best colleges, and in the past, best graduate schools. This year, we put out a special in-depth book entitled Best Business Schools for the first time that focuses on the MBA and master's programs in business. And so my role is to create, to oversee the creation of all of the sort of helpful advice and articles about the programs that go around the rankings and present the rankings in print. I think the advantage to being able to see the rankings in print is that it's a way to be able to scan a lot of information on one page easily without, you know, a lot of scrolling and clicking, but it just a much more compact visual version of the much more comprehensive material that is available on usnews.com.
Got it. Now, in both your minds, what is the purpose or the primary benefits of the rankings and the material offered by U.S. News through the rankings?
Well, my feeling is that it is a great tool for families at the undergraduate level, for potential grad students, to be able to have a place to start with a lot of information. I mean, it's we never say that it should be the basis for a decision.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be a rank. And I believe that, you know, it's pretty clear from what we know that students don't use college rank to make their decision.
As the sole basis.
Right, exactly.
That would be the incorrect use of the rankings.
But we feel that, I mean, the type of data that you can see if you open a guidebook or look at usnews.com are things like graduation rate in 6 years and freshman retention rate and class size. And in the case of the business school guide, how much of the class has a job at graduation and how much has a job at 3 months after graduation and what the starting salaries are like. So what you are able to do is get ideas and get a sense of, by looking at, say, the test scores, where you might be a real good fit, and sort of begin to narrow your choices. So to me, that's its real value. And as I said before, to make schools visible to you that may never have popped onto your radar before.
Bob, do you have anything to add to that?
I definitely agree with Anne. I mean, I think that this is using traffic from our website, not the guidebook. The people are using the website more broadly than just focusing on the top-ranked schools, which do, and, you know, get the focus. You know, what Harvard, Yale, or University of Chicago does is important. But basically, 90% of the people who are visiting usnews.com are looking at schools outside of the top 10 national universities and top 10 liberal arts. I'm citing that as sort of proof that people are looking at this information broadly as a tool to help them. We also knew that there was an information gap at that time, you know, which in some ways has now been growing, you know, a need gap to inform people of the differences between schools so they can make comparative choices. I mean, that's still the core reason why we're doing the rankings. It has a consumer purpose. I mean, we're definitely aware that people in higher ed look at the rankings. They're not using them for information to decide where they go to school.
I'm going to be very frank about it. What I frequently tell people is that the U.S. News rankings are a treasure trove of data. The rankings themselves, the fact that one school is ranked 1 or 3 or 5 or 15, or the comparison between 6, 7, and 8, or 16, 17, and 18, is less valuable than the actual data that the rankings contain. That, to me, just this rich collection of data, which is hopefully reliable, that, to me, is the biggest benefit of the U.S. News rankings. So in my work, I frequently suggest to applicants, you know, use the data in the rankings to do research. And I frequently say it's a great place to start your school research. It's a terrible place to end it.
Well, yeah, we would agree.
Yeah, we would agree. I would say that there's the ranking ranges that you cited, there isn't a meaningful difference between the schools, but there's certainly a meaningful difference when you compare the 10th ranked school to the 80th, they're at least on the statistical profile and the indicators, there's a meaningful difference.
But I think, you know, really what you said about the data is so key, because with college costing what it costs today, I think a lot of people make the decision of where to go without considering things like, oh, I might not actually be able to graduate in 6 years. I mean, if you scan down the graduation rates, just as an example, from top to bottom, I mean, it's quite surprising that, you know, some of the, you could see that some schools are in the 30 to 40% range and even lower for a 6 year graduation rate. So I think, and freshman retention too. So many students, I think it's something like a quarter of freshmen don't return for sophomore year, whether it's because they transfer or they have financial problems or whatever. But that's quite a considerable number of those probably failed to make a really careful decision.
We definitely agree with your point that students and their parents, they should visit a school, that they should consider the environment.
Absolutely.
Obviously, how much it costs, what are the activities, what kind of majors, or if you're interested in business or engineering, that would mean a different choice than if you're, you know, some other choices. Do you care about sports or activities, or, you know, all these other things are vitally important to consider, and you have to go way beyond. If you're just based on rankings, that'd be the easy and incorrect way to make such a big decision.
One of my staff, I told my staff that I was going to be talking with you folks, and one of them asked, why are some programs ranked or included in the rankings and some aren't? For example, Tufts PA program isn't in the rankings of physician assistant programs. Do you know why, or how is that part of it handled?
For the graduate rankings, generally speaking, you have to have an accredited program at the time we create the ranking universe. So I'm not sure whether Tufts had a fully accredited physician's assistant program, but were they looking at the guidebook or USnews.com? Because I don't have access to USnews.com right now, but definitely all the accredited physician's assistant programs were included.
But it's a matter of, so for graduate schools, it's a matter of accreditation, and I think there's a minimum size of the class, isn't there, or is it the survey responses that has to have a minimum size?
Well, no, graduate rankings, it's not based on, you mean to be ranked or to be included on the website? To be included in the full-time MBA program rankings, you have to have, I think, 20 graduates and a certain percent of your full-time graduates that are seeking. So there is a minimum size for the graduating class. For the other, and for part-time law, there's an enrollment threshold. But all the other rankings, the grad rankings, there isn't an enrollment threshold to be included in the rankings. It's whether you meet the accreditation standard, or for engineering and education, it's whether you offer a PhD in engineering or a PhD or ED in education, then you're included.
Okay. So it really varies depending upon what's actually being ranked, which frankly makes a lot of sense. Do you ever audit the information from the schools? Are you at all concerned about the veracity of the information you're using, given that admissions directors can lose their jobs if they fall in the rankings and this kind of thing? I mean, there's a tremendous incentive to falsify the information that you're basing the rankings on.
There have been some cases, obviously some highly visible cases, where schools have misreported, and we've taken steps to, and we find that out, or the school says they've done it publicly, and it's resulted in having a higher rank, then we take them out of the rankings. I mean, we believe it obviously happens since we've written about it and schools have done it. We do think that it's in rare cases versus prevalent cases, I mean, versus many cases. If you're asking a question, does U.S. News, as a straight out question, audit schools, meaning like they do in the SEC public accounting to get a No, we're not auditing data that way. We are, in many cases, cross-checking the data with public sources as a way of verifying the data.
Sometimes, as I mentioned, I use the data that you provide, but I also will, like, let's say, use MCAS's medical school admissions requirements, MSAR, as well as U.S. News. And sometimes I see differences in the data. So, for example, U.S. News shows that a total of 8,068 applicants applied to Mayo Clinic. 606 were interviewed, 168 were accepted, and 97 enrolled. MSAR shows 4,991 verified applications, 437 as opposed to 606 interviewed, and 52 matriculated. Now, those are fairly significant differences. And the funny thing is that the school supplied the data to both MSAR and U.S. News. Do you have any idea what's causing the difference?
Maybe. No. I mean, I'm not sure, actually, the school supplied the data to MSAR because doesn't the medical school have like an application system that you actually apply through?
Yeah, that's MCAS.
Right. So they may be tallying the data themselves. Okay. The answer is I don't know the difference in why. So it's not something that I can answer. I mean,
okay.
Is it possible it might be a different school year?
I
don't think it's a different school, but even if it was, that's an awfully big difference. It'd be very surprising to have that big of a jump or fall in applications from one cycle to the next. And one possible thought that I had is that because you show 8,000, that your number may be the total number of applicants who actually click the box, you know, I want to apply to Mayo Clinic in this case. But the MSAR number may be the actual number who submitted secondary applications. And that's, you know, there would be a certain weeding out there. That was one possibility that I thought of. But I was wondering if you knew, and if you don't, that's fine. Hi, everybody. The next couple of minutes are an insertion into the interview, just to let you know what happened after the interview. The day after our interview, just really several working hours after I spoke to Bob and Ann, I had an email from Bob. And he said, thanks for the very interesting conversation we had yesterday. As a data person, I was intrigued by your Mayo question, and I have looked into it. I have found this link on AAMC, which was the AAMC fact table. And on that document, AAMC's numbers and U.S. News numbers were very, very close. I think they were in three applications of each other's. And Bob said that, you know, that is probably the accurate number because they both got the number from Mayo. So I said, that's probably is the accurate number, but then you probably have a discrepancy between two data sources produced by AAMC, not so much between AAMC and U.S. News, but between two different pieces of information on the AAMC website. So I told Bob that I would email AAMC. They have a data request at AAMC.org email address and ask them to please reconcile the two numbers on their site, two different sources on the AAMC website. One is the facts table and one is MSAR. And I wrote them on June 22nd. Actually, I think it was June 21st I wrote them. And the next day I had a response from AAMC. Bob asked that I share it with him. He still wanted to know what was going on. AAMC wrote me back the next day. Thank you for bringing this to our attention. It appears that the MSAR applications to the Arizona campus have been left off, not been calculated into the MSAR total. And I've notified my colleagues we'll resolve this issue. This is from somebody at AAMC. And then I shared that with Bob, who by then had already looked into it further and found out that AAMC was not including Mayo's Arizona campus in the MSAR. And indeed, that's exactly what AAMC said. My point here is, A, it's okay to say you don't know, but to highlight the fact that both Bob Morris at U.S. News and AAMC takes the integrity of the data very, very seriously and very promptly followed up both parties on the discrepancy that I uncovered in preparing for the call. And back to the interview. As you alluded to earlier, Bob, and I think you also, Anne, many blame the rankings for the increasing importance of test scores in admissions. Do you agree with that assessment? Why or why not? And Anne, why don't you start this one off?
I think that it's probably true that, you know, the rankings make test scores visible, and the schools may be in some way kind of trying to raise their test scores. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that's related to the rankings, it may just be because their goal is to really improve the sort of the quality of the students that they're bringing in. But so I do think that that's one thing, that one trend that may in fact be happening. But there's at the same time, there's this very interesting counter trend that schools, a growing percentage of schools are going test optional and making tests not really a necessary part of the admissions process anymore. So I think it's kind of a mixed bag, and I don't know how much the rankings really factor into that, to tell you the truth.
Bob? I'm not 100% sure what you mean by increasing the importance of test scores in admission, but I will say that there's a lot of trends with test scores, and you're aware of them. Like, one is currently of the 1,400 schools that we rank, I just ran these figures the other day, I think like nearly 30% of them are now test optional. So there's been a growing trend for schools declaring themselves test optional. And so at least among that nearly 30%, they're less important than they were when they were required for all students versus required for some. So that trend is going on. And most recently, which I know you're aware of, University of Chicago,
right,
for their class of that enrolls in the fall of 2019 will be test optional. Then there's the point maybe you're making that among the schools where it's still required for all, their test scores are still heavily emphasized, and they're important for those schools, which I think is true. But I don't think our ranking, just by the nature of the rise in test optional schools, has, to me, that's proof that our ranking is not inhibiting, it's not maintaining tests being required. It's schools still feel that they can become test optional. It's not making a meaningful difference to them in our ranking by doing that. So they're making that choice.
I do know that from the articles that we do, because one of the most important components of the Best Colleges Guidebook is a section on really understanding the importance of the application and the essay, and you know how to present yourself in a way that will be most likely to be impressive to the admissions office. The admissions deans that we talk to talk about the fact that academics is really, you know, there are many, many, many things that they look at in bringing in their class, but mm-hmm. academics is really foundational.
Absolutely.
And mostly that's grades, but you know, they're very interested in the test scores are one measure that really actually help them compare students across the very diverse school systems that they're accepting students from. And AP classes are important too, because that shows a certain level of a sort of ability to handle the rigor of the college courses. And I think that's a very big concern for admissions deans and admissions offices. Are they bringing in students who are going to succeed?
Right. I mean, is that the point you're trying to make? I don't know the exact question. The test scores are a factor in our ranking. Yeah, the test scores count 8.125%. So they're a factor. They're certainly not the most important factor. Graduation, retention rates, and reputation are more important.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, still, despite the rise in test optional, around 75% of the schools still require tests for all students, according to how they report their data to us. So it's still the national standard. So at those schools, they've decided it's worthwhile to have students as part of their application decision have the test and that's the standard. And our methodology is reflecting that standard.
Right. I don't have any problem whatsoever personally, and you're including the test score as a factor in the rankings. I have seen articles over the last 20 years where deans were very, very critical of U.S. News in particular for including test scores in the ranking. it seems to me, especially on the graduate school level, that if I look at business school or to a lesser extent, medical school, and at law school prior to 2008, the test score numbers were going up. And I don't know that people are really getting smarter or that they are that much more prepared. But I think the way that they are prepared is that obviously they more and more are taking test prep. And
yes,
test prep is getting better and better. The other factor I think that has had very much unintended consequences and has heightened competition enormously at the elite universities, undergraduate universities, frankly, is the Common App. The fact that it's very easy to send off multiple applications to many top universities has caused people to do so. It's in terms of the time, it's lowered the cost of doing so. And I think that has contributed to a certain frenzy in the undergraduate higher school, if you will, higher ranked school admissions market. In the graduate market, you know, what I've seen is just an unending rise in average GMAT scores. So if you look at a top 10 business school, U.S. News top 10 business school, I think the average GMAT now is 724. And there was only one with an average GMAT of under 720. You know, when I first started doing this work, a score of 700 was considered excellent. So are the schools looking more at the GMAT score? Is test prep improving? You know, I think those are all legitimate questions. I also think that the GMAT and the ranking is being used, the average GMAT score and the ranking is being used to impress alumni, potential donors, and potential students. In that sense, it may be being used in ways that you folks never intended and the test makers never intended.
Well, I mean, that's true. I mean, you're talking about, generally speaking, the GMAT or GRE is required at the full-time MBA program level. There are some part-time MBA programs where they're not requiring it,
right.
but they're relatively rare. I don't really have a theory. It's a good point you raise. I haven't asked any business school why. I have different theories than you have. There could be a bigger applicant pool. There's more international students.
Right.
There's test prep, so the students are getting higher scores.
I think at the elite level, at least at the undergraduate level, we know that, you know, the Ivy League schools, the top universities are turning away full classes of qualified students. So
with perfect scores, right? I know you've heard the Ivy League deans say that we could fill our class with 1600s, or they make a claim, right? You've heard that, right?
Right. Oh, absolutely.
Right. So they're filling their class with close to 1600. But
I mean, I think at the undergraduate level, at that level, it really is a numbers game. They can take they've got many, many, many more people with perfect SAT scores than they can take.
Right.
And it's probably true at the same way at the most elite graduate programs, too, I would think.
You don't get the perfect scores as much like as you do in the undergraduate level, but you certainly get very, very high scores, and those scores are going up. Like I said, you know, every year, if I take the average GMAT scores, in particular for the top 10 schools, business schools, they're going up. The MCAS came out with a new scoring system for the MCAT, which we're actually going to talk about in a second, and they hope that the average score would be right around 500 and schools would focus less on the highest MCAT score and be looking, well, you know, you've gotten this average. It qualifies you for our school, and they'll go look at other things. The MCAT has been going up ever since they came out with the new scoring system. So I think for matriculating medical students in the U.S. So I'm not – again, I don't know that – I would agree with blaming U.S. News for this, as deans have done. I can remember being at a law school conference years ago where the dean got up and was just blasting people who focused solely on GPA and LSAT scores as criteria for admissions to law schools. It's a holistic approach. It's much more diverse than that, you know, going on and on and on. He got off the stage. They had a panel discussion. It was all law school admissions people, and all they talked about was GPA and LSAT. That was it. Now, obviously, now some schools are taking the GRE too. So, you know, again, I'm not sure it's fair or appropriate or right to blame or credit U.S. News for this focus.
And I certainly think that in the graduate programs you're citing, AMCAT is required. Oh, yeah. GMAT is generally required. LSAT, these are all those programs require the test. So, I mean, the U.S. News isn't setting that standard. So we're reflecting of the standard of set by the accrediting body or the effectively, in this case, is the accrediting body or the I guess for the business schools, it's by the schools themselves.
Right.
And certainly the highly ranked schools have better scores. I mean, there it takes higher scores to get in the better schools. If your scores aren't as high, you're not going to be able to get in, generally speaking, to the higher ranked schools. So it is a way of delineating the quality of the class.
And also, as Ann pointed out earlier, this is a way that applicants can assess their competitiveness and assess whether it makes sense for them to invest the time and money in applying. Can you give us an overview of how you put together the rankings? What's the process? I guess, Bob, why don't you start in terms of the actual rankings, and then Ann, you can describe the additional content and production process.
Okay, I'll be glad to. I also have an answer for your Tufts question.
My Tufts question? Oh, okay.
Well, no, you have a
Tufts. Yeah, the Tufts, right, yeah, the PA program.
Okay, so we actually ranked the physician's assistant program the last time. The rankings were published in 2015. So that means we did the surveys in 2014. Tufts program didn't start until its first class began in January 2013.
Got it.
So at the time that we did it, they had provisional accreditation. At the time we did the current physician's assistant ranking, this isn't the case now, and you have to be fully accredited, not provisionally accredited, to be included in the ranking.
Got it.
In terms of how we put the, I can talk about this rank. My general answer will apply to the best colleges rankings and at least the main grad rankings, where we combine statistical data and reputational data, that we conduct our own surveys. And all the data that we're collecting is now collected in-house. We have statistical data and reputational data. So this is how we're putting it together. So a number of months, usually 3 or 4 months or at least a few months before the rankings are finalized, we work on updating the survey instruments, and we launch the surveys to the various respondents, the business schools or law schools, or colleges, and then we send out the reputational surveys to the college presidents or the law school deans or the medical school deans. Then we have a data collection process, you know, which lasts, you know, 2 or 3 months. And as part of that, we're also QAing the data. And then at the end of that process, we have a data analysis phase. And then we publish the rankings on the website a few months after we started the process. So that's how they're put together. We have a computer model and to do the rankings. That's like a 2-minute version of something that takes 4 months.
Wow.
Or so, because we're not doing the rankings simultaneously. I mean, we do, after we collect the data, you know, our ranking model, we have the ranking indicators, and we calculate the scores of the ranking indicators, and then we weight them. And then, you know, the schools that have the highest weighted scores, you know, do best in the rankings. And then we output the data. Some of it appears in the guidebook, and some of it, and the rankings are also published on usnews.com.
Okay, great.
In the meantime, while he's doing that, my staff and I are figuring out, like, what are the most compelling trends happening, either in business education as far as for the business book or in undergraduate educations. And What schools do we want to take readers inside? And then, so we come up with a story lineup. We're right now in the middle of producing Best Colleges, mm-hmm. Colleges guidebook that will be published this fall. I think right about the beginning of October. And it's set up so that the format is the rankings are the centerpiece of it, but we have one large chapter that is intended to give students a lot of information about programs, about how college, their options, so that they can start to think about where they belong and what might be of interest. And then we have a chapter where we actually travel to three different states, and it's what we call road trips. So we take students inside close-ups on 12 different colleges and universities a year.
And this is both on usnews.com and in the guidebook, or is it just one?
Yeah. Oh no, all of the content is published both places. And we have a chapter on, as I mentioned before, on what you need to know to impress admissions, and as a high school student, how you should think about yourself and how you should plan your high school career in order to essentially grow and, become a person that colleges will welcome into their midst. And then a chapter on how to find the money, sort of running through the financial aid process and scholarships and loans. So after the stories are all assigned to writers, we figure out where we want to take photos. And then there's a process where we edit everything and get it signed off on by the writers. And then at the whole time, the art department is in gear producing layouts, and it's sort of a throwback to the good old print magazine days. And we're looking at layouts and reading proofs and wrapping everything up at just around Labor Day.
When do you, how much of a lead time do you need, let's say, to have it all wrapped up before, do you need a month lead time or 2 weeks or a week, or what is it? I'm just curious.
So the whole process takes place over about 5 months, I would say.
From start to finish. But let's say from when you have the content wrapped up and the rankings wrapped up, I assume, mm-hmm. It's not like a day or two later that it goes live, right?
Oh,
no, and right. It's usually it goes live. We usually have the rankings done the way we're doing them right now. The rankings are actually done upwards of 6 weeks before they appear in print, or maybe more. They're usually done 3 or 4 weeks. If they go live in mid-September, they're usually finalized in mid-August.
Yeah, I mean, you can't just go, it's not like flipping a switch. It's way too complex for that.
Yeah, well, there's a whole process of web publishing, and that's another whole step that would have added more to the explanation of database publishing. And
rather than publish all of the stories from the guidebook at the same time, we tend to publish them over a period of several weeks. So, mm-hmm. They kind of roll out as opposed to all being published
in fact, it used to be, there was a time when there was both the weekly magazine and guidebook and the web was younger, that there was an effort that everything went live at the same time, that the guidebook would become available and the weekly magazine would be published and the website would be launched at more or less simultaneously. Now, with no weekly magazine, the guidebook goes to press slightly after the rankings are published on usnews.com.
Okay.
So it's actually going to press after they're first available on usnews.com.
All right. That was very interesting. Thank you. Why did you develop the best, or why did US News develop the best B schools ranking, the paper version, as opposed to the old grad schools rankings? And can you tell us a little bit about what it is? Anne, why don't you take this one?
Thing. Obviously, we're still very much doing the graduate school project and ranking and online content. But the book was very well received and popular for a number of years. But what we realized is that we weren't able, breadth is great, but we weren't able to offer depth in the same way that we would like to for all of those different types of programs. And based on the fact that we really felt that, okay, business is one of the most popular undergraduate programs and certainly one of the most popular graduate programs, it would really benefit more people to have a really in-depth look at best business schools. And the book is, you know, the rankings, as I said, are really the centerpiece of it. We have the best MBA programs, best part-time MBA programs, best online and best executive MBA programs. And then kind of as a bonus, we include the best undergraduate business programs. But the meat of the book is a look at a very interesting landscape in business education right now. To give people sort of an overview of what's happening, what the trends are, and what they might want to consider as they are thinking about picking a program. So, for instance, we looked at the fact that MBAs are becoming way more specialized. And if you want to get an MBA in data analytics or healthcare or energy and clean tech, you can do that. You can get an MBA now that's essentially focused around socially conscious and sustainable business.
Right.
You can get a one-year MBA much more easily now in this country than you used to be able to. And one of the most interesting trends was how global and international U.S. programs are becoming. One example that we featured in this book is a partnership between UVA and a Chinese and a Spanish business school so that students in 10 months can essentially study in all three places and end up with I think, 2 degrees and 1 certificate.
I actually interviewed the head of that program a couple of years ago. It's a fascinating program.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, MIT has just started a new business school with the Central Bank of Malaysia. Yale is partnering with, I think, schools in Canada,
yeah,
Hong Kong, Paris, and Brazil. I mean, this is really so. The guidebook goes into a lot of that just to give people a sense of as they're choosing the kinds of things they ought to be aware of. And then again, we also help students understand, you know, what it takes to make the cut and the various ways that they might be able to pay for it without going heavily into debt.
Yeah. Right. And it also, as Ann said, we didn't drop any of the grad rankings. They're all still being done on usnews.com. There aren't any plans of not doing all the same grad rankings. So it's going to be the business school book, since US News is also for a major publication, we're the only one who is doing this many variety of business school rankings and all the different ways business school is being done. So it made sense to create for the program that has the largest interest in enrollment to create a book just for that.
Right. And as you pointed out, the MBA may be the flagship degree, but there are so many variations within the MBA. And then there's Masters in Management, there's Masters in Finance, there's Masters in Marketing. There are so many different graduate management programs at this point in time. You know, it's not what it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. So,
right. I think that, you know, the fact that the two-year MBA may be still the real gold standard at the elite schools, it doesn't mean that that's the only way to go anymore,
right,
for sure.
The
trend in one-year MBAs, I thought, was really interesting. And we also actually, and we do talk about the niche master's degrees in the book, and we also feature the real impressive rise in certificate programs.
Right.
So that and sort of mini MBAs, I think they're being called or nicknamed.
I think you also have something on online degrees also in that book, don't you?
Right. Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have online MBAs and then online business masters that aren't MBAs. And there again, for our online rankings, we're the only ranker is actually doing the rankings at the degree level. the other people are doing online rankings or taking general government IPEDS data at the institutional level and doing a ranking based on it, which is not representative of the online program.
I see. And what are both your plans for the guides and the rankings going forward? Anne, do you want to start?
Sure. I think that for at least the next year, we'll probably stick with what we've got here. I really love the idea of the best business schools focus, and I could see in the future if it's popular, maybe seeing if we want to expand and do something for one of the other, you know, kind of maybe expand it into a series, perhaps.
Well, maybe have something on healthcare, you know, MD-DO,
yeah, yeah.
PA.
Yeah. Certainly healthcare is huge. I could definitely, that's certainly huge.
That was like, I think that would fit. Bob, do you have anything to add?
We're always looking for, we don't have any announcements for the podcast, but we're definitely exploring other ways of doing more, you know, rankings. I guess I'll have to watch this space to see what comes next in terms of the rankings. You know, we're studying if there's other online programs where there's a large number of programs are being added to maybe add other online degree areas. So we're looking at all kinds of things.
I think in terms of, again, how I look at the rankings, again, I look primarily for the data. But when I do look at the rankings, one thing I find particularly useful is the more specific you are, the more valuable it is. So when you talk about, again, going back to the business schools, you know, and you talk about those schools with the best reputation in international business or finance or consulting or whatever area you're choosing, or you talk about medical schools in terms of their strength in, you know, family medicine, internal medicine, et cetera. I think, I mean, again, as long as there's some statistical basis to go on in making that, either reputational or statistical, I find that very, very helpful and very useful for applicants.
We agree that that's probably one of the things that's in demand most is undergraduate majors. And of course, we are doing undergraduate business and engineering, the two largest discrete areas. We are studying ways of doing other fields. It's not going to be part of the upcoming ranking, but there could be, you know, like nursing could be a discrete undergraduate field, or there's other areas where you can, you know, not to rank 1,200 undergraduate econ departments, but areas where there's discrete interest in undergraduate education or nursing or other areas.
I want to thank you both, Anne and Bob, for a wonderful interview. We've spent almost an hour, and I don't want to abuse your generosity. Where can listeners find the U.S. News College and Grad Rankings?
On usnews.com. I think even in Google, if you search usnews.com College Rankings,
You think Google will find it, huh? I think it'll come up pretty fast.
Well, we definitely have SEO authority for search engine authority in some of the areas.
Yeah, probably best colleges.
And the grad rankings, we're the only people doing some of the fields and for the grad rankings.
And both best colleges and best business schools are available on Amazon.com.
Okay, great. So we're going to link from the show notes at exhibit.com/265 to the U.S. News grad rankings, as well as the undergraduate rankings and other relevant resources, just in case Google doesn't return it to you. But again, Bob and Anne, thank you very much. Listener, thank you too for tuning into this, our 265th episode. If you found this show worthwhile, please make sure you don't miss any others. Subscribe through your favorite podcatcher. We have subscribe links in the show notes at exhibit.com/265. I also want to thank our sponsor today, Fit In and Stand Out, The Paradox at the Heart of Admissions, and that's Accepted's Guide to Helping You Handle That Paradox with Aplomb. Download your free copy at exhibit.com/FISO for Fit In and Stand Out. This is Admissions Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.